I'm Michael Goldfarb, in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The assassination of Julius Caesar in 44 BC is arguably the most important political murder in history. Certainly, it's the most talked about. It marked the key moment in Rome's transition from republic of a kind to empire. The backstory for Caesar's murder, as it has been memorialized by Shakespeare and Hollywood, is one of ambition humbled, a dangerous demagogue preemptively silenced, a republic saved from dictatorship. And at the center of this brutish tale is a nasty view of the Roman people as no more than a rabble. It's a view that Hollywood almost always defaults to when it does the big Roman epic, most recently in the Oscar-winning film Gladiator.
150 days of games.
It was cleverer than I thought.
Clever. The whole of Rome would be laughing at him. They weren't so afraid of his Praetorian.
Fear and wonder, a powerful combination.
You really think the people are going to be seduced by that?
I think he knows what Rome is. Rome's the mob. Conjure magic for them and they'll be distracted. We'll take away their freedom and still their war. The beating heart of Rome is not the marble of the Senate, it's the sand of the Colosseum. You bring them death, and they will love him for it.
Sir Derek Jacobi in the epic The Gladiator. Michael Parenti is an historian of the left, and he begs to differ with this view of Rome's people and of Julius Caesar himself. In his new book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome, he portrays the great Caesar as a true man of the people, and the people of Rome as something other than a mob. Connection listeners, are you ready to buy the view that Julius Caesar was more democrat than despot? And when it comes to power and politics, do you see parallels between today's America and yesterday's Rome in the time of Julius Caesar? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join in the conversation. And we're joined now by Michael Parenti, who's on a line from San Francisco. Michael Parenti, hello.
Hello, Michael.
Why did you choose to write this book at this moment?
It did offer some interesting parallels, and I was just reading, I was doing intensive reading of Greek philosophy and history, and I thought, well, the Romans can never be as fascinating as their Mediterranean cousins, but I started reading Roman history, and the politics of it is certainly, I don't know if they're as good as the Greeks when it comes to art and philosophy, but boy, the politics were fascinating, and one of the conclusions I came to, Michael, is that ancient history is not so ancient. There are forces going that from which we can learn some things. I also thought that a lot of that history has been miswritten and misinterpreted. The standard view of modern historians was to uncritically accept the view of the ancient historians, who themselves uncritically accepted the view of the elite actors in the Roman Republic.
Well, Michael, later on in the conversation, I definitely want to come to historiography and precisely mm-hmm. those points about who has written history down the millennia since Julius was alive. But what was it particularly about Julius Caesar? I mean, the point of the book, it seems to me, is twofold. One is to claim Caesar more as a democrat than as he's popularly portrayed, and two is to try and reclaim the people of Rome as being something other, as they've, you know, almost become caricatured in Hollywood movies.
Right. Well, as a democrat, I mean, he leaves a lot to be desired. He wasn't, I don't know if I would call him a democrat, but he certainly was responsive to the democratic elements. There were elements in Rome that wanted to build guilds for the freedmen, for the penniless proletariat, and even for the slaves, and wanted to free the slaves. Caesar never went that far. There were democratic elements in Rome that really wanted to break the aristocratic power of the Roman Senate. Caesar never went that far, although Caesar wanted to co-opt the Senate and keep them busy with things and have them cooperate as one of the basic elements of the Republic. So he was, I would call him a popular reformer who went in the direction of Democrat. Now, it's true, for instance, when he conquered in the Civil War, when he took over Greece, Greece was a Roman province at the time, he gave the Athenians a democratic constitution, which they hadn't had under Rome for 100 years or more. And he did strengthen the popular assemblies. He did keep the secret ballot. He did force the Senate to publish its debates and its votes so that they could be more publicly accountable. But he did accumulate. The truth is, he did accumulate a lot of power. That power, I see, was his attempt to break and challenge the entrenched power of the rich oligarchy.
Of which he was a part and was part of a noble family of long lineage.
Yes, of long lineage, a patrician family. But there was, in the Roman aristocracy, and not everybody in the Senate was a member of the aristocracy. There was an elite, you know, 30 or 40 families or so. That aristocracy was very conservative, but there was a break-off element who are called the populares, which really literally in Latin means demagogues. I mean, it wasn't a flattering term, but we use it anyway. And they started siding with the people. They started saying, and this was Caesar's point, if I die, if I can't finish my work, you're going to see a civil war. And that was very prophetic. That's exactly what happened, of course. And that was the end of the 500-year republic after he was killed.
But here's the question, Michael. I mean, was he killed because he was a true populist trying to improve the lot of ordinary people? Or was he killed, as Shakespeare says in the great speech, because of his ambition?
No, Michael, you know, ambition was the common coin. I mean, that was the common currency of the realm. All these men, they understood ambition. They forgave ambition. They admired ambition. But when ambition was being used to accumulate power, which was then being used for things like rent cancellations for the poor, land redistribution to give it back to the small farmers and take it away from the big plantation owners who used slave labor, luxury taxes on the very rich.
Skyboxes, you know, at the Colosseum, is that the deal?
Skyboxes at the Colosseum. I don't know if that's an interesting joke, because in fact at the Colosseum the primary rung, the lowest rung closest to the action, was reserved for the upper class. So when you always say, the mob wanted their circuses and their bloodletting in the arena, in fact, the rich and the well-placed attended those spectacles probably in a higher percentage than did the poor.
Okay. It's interesting. I refer to Shakespeare's great speech, Friends, Romans, Countrymen. And in a curious way, he goes both ways, because he Mark Antony comes out and says, rhetorically, was this ambition, the various great things that Caesar did? But at the very end, he reads Caesar's will. And it's interesting because I think it does, in a sense, although I doubt that Shakespeare would have considered himself a progressive historian in any way, it does almost make your point for you.
Here is the will, and under Caesar's seal, to every Roman citizen he gives, to every several man, 75 drachmas! Moreover, he hath left you all his walks, his private arbors and new planted orchards on this side Tiber. He hath left them you and to your heirs forever. Common pleasures to walk abroad and recreate yourselves. Here was a Caesar. When comes such another?
Ever, never!
Marlon Brando in the film Julius Caesar. And, of course, that's the flip side. On the one hand, yes, Caesar is giving all his land, not all his land, but some of his land to the people of Rome. But the background noise, they certainly sound like a mob.
Yeah. Well, they are really stirred up and upset that Caesar has been killed. He's the first person who's given them a fair shake. As I said, you know, debt cancellation and land redistribution and job programs. He was setting up job programs so people could work and get some money. He was sort of a New Deal. If we have to be anachronistic about this and use modern parallels, that's probably what I would say he was. as far as being a usurper, the reason I argue against the intentions of the aristocrats and all the historians who came after and bought into that line is that, in fact, they were not opposed to dictatorship. When Sulla came in 80 BC, now that's almost 35 years before Caesar was at the height of his power. Sulla was an oligarch. He murdered about 10,000 Democrats, including 50 senators who weren't conservative enough, and including about 1,000 equestrians who were also part of the officer class. Well, these Roman senators and oligarchs, they didn't condemn him. As Cicero, looking back on Sulla, said it was an admirable achievement, although, you know, sometimes he was a bit, he lacked a little moderation here or there. So he gave him a big hug and a little slap on the wrist, too.
I'm going to interrupt you there just for a second because, I mean, some of the detail is a little to the side, because what I really want to get to is we know much about what happened because of the chroniclers, and they chronicled the upper classes. But you're making assertions about how the ordinary people of Rome saw things. Is there any chronicle at all of that? I mean, what is the historical record on what an ordinary Roman carpenter living in a 7-story-high wooden building that's about to collapse actually thought?
We have very little direct testimony of the common people. What we do have are just references to their actions and to their sentiments by others, you know, in their letters or proclamations or in descriptions of the conflict. We do know that the Roman common people from, say, 700-something B.C. down to 500-something fought hard against monarchy, against oligarchy. They perpetrated the Aventine secession. They refused to join the army. They refused to participate. They fought until they got popular assemblies, until they got the People's Tribune. So they did fight for democratic goals. I mean, democracy is a wonderful invention by the people of history to protect themselves against the abuses of wealth. It was their way of saying, we need some protection and we need a piece of the state, of the government, to protect us from you overweening, insatiable oligarchs who will take everything, pay none of the taxes, get all the benefits of civic organization, get all the wealth, all the riches, wipe out our jobs and put in slave labor instead. We need to fight back and get a piece of the pie. So the people were, as they have been throughout history, a democratic force. Now they can be also misled at times, you know, they can or fall short and not be up to the challenge because of the repressive forces that exist. Mm-hmm. Don't forget the Roman oligarchs, these senate aristocrats, had their death squads. They had each one of them had a private patron army of...
You hear the music. We're coming to the end of the segment. I was going to be very clever and talk about parallels between Rome and the U.S., but you're talking about bringing in private assassins, and I'm afraid and what the oligarchs did to protect their power. It's not quite the same. But more broadly speaking, Rome was a republic. It became an empire, connection listeners. America prides itself on being a republic, but we see in recent times acting in a way that the rest of the world finds imperial. Do you think that there are parallels? What can we learn from talking about Rome in the time of Julius Caesar? 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK, to join in the conversation. And we have some calls in already, and we will be getting to your calls after the break. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking about the death of Julius Caesar this hour. Who killed him? Well, we sort of know that. Why? That's up for discussion with my guest, Michael Parenti, author of The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. And here's yet another Hollywood discussion. The film Spartacus, Crassus, played by Laurence Olivier, is talking to Julius Caesar, a young Julius Caesar, played by John Gavin, I think later to be an ambassador of the United States somewhere, and asking him to stay true to his patrician principles.
Taking the house. In the fourth ward.
Not a very splendid house, either.
Mm-hmm. You feasted 11,000 plebeians in the field of Mars.
Scarcely could have been called a feast.
For 200 years, your family and mine have been members of the Equestrian Order and the Patrician Party, servants and rulers of Rome. Why have you left us for Gracchus and the mob?
I've left no one, least of all Rome. This much I've learned from Gracchus. Rome is the mob.
No. Rome is an eternal thought in the mind of God.
I had no idea you'd grown religious.
It doesn't matter. If there were no gods at all, I'd revere them. If there were no Rome, I'd dream of her. As I want you to do. I want you to come back to your own kind. I beg you to.
I'd like to bring into the conversation now, yet again, John Gavin's an American, but when it comes to casting movies, the Romans are always played by the Brits. Have you noticed that? Now, why is that? I mean, it's shorthand, isn't it, for decadent aristocrats from ancient, from a corrupt empire. You don't have to worry about it. Laurence Olivier, the ultimate, he was very good as a decadent aristocrat. I'd like that crisp accent. You like that, don't you?
Well, yeah, you can't have a, you know, well, you had Marlon Brando playing Mark Antony.
That's true.
But
he was the good. He's a good guy, right? He's a good guy. But curious, and just one other aside, the film was written by Dalton Trumbo, who Michael probably shared a great deal of your political sentiments. He'd been blacklisted.
Yeah, and it was produced by Eddie Lewis, who was a very progressive fellow. Yeah.
And they were trying to make a point with that film. And successfully sometimes. I'd like to bring into the conversation now Mary Lefkowitz, who is a professor of classics at Wellesley College and the author of several books, including Women's Life in Greece and Rome. Mary Lefkowitz, you've heard what we've been talking about and what Michael Parenti's broad thesis is. Is there something new in this?
To me, not really, though I'm very glad to hear it again. I think the only sort of spin I put on it, slight difference, is that I think Caesar used the people. I don't see in his writings or in whatever I know about him any real, sincere, deep concern for democracy. The people are there because they're helpful to him. He's nice to his soldiers in his army, cares about them because he needs their loyalty, because he's going to do something when he crosses the Rubicon that is illegal.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Carol is calling from Boston, Massachusetts.
Hi there.
Hi.
Hi. I'm actually at work, so I'm doing this on the fly. But I have the radio on, and when I heard you bring up the subject of what you were talking about, I had to get right on the horn here. I'm actually a locally based actor, and had done the play Julius Caesar several years ago. During the discussion that we have that typically goes on during play readings before you actually get into the meat and bones of the acting and so forth, I had brought up several of the points that Mr. Parenti is making about Julius Caesar's motives and his intentions and his background and so forth, even though I was not playing the title role, obviously.
There are what, two or three women in the whole play with speaking
right,
parts?
Right. I was Calpurnia and another locally based actor. Paula Plum was Portia. And then there was some cross-gender casting. I mean, I played a soldier at one point, as did a few of the other women.
Great. So what's your point for Michael Parenti?
Well, the point that I was making is that I tried to bring up, during the discussion, tried to bring up several of these points, not that I was trying to be the director or to go against his wishes, but just to give some background, I had read several of the points that Mr. Parenti was making, that basically he was not the evil dictator that has been portrayed throughout history. I think a lot of people, and it's a testament to Shakespeare, know what they know of Julius Caesar and of Rome during that time is what they have learned from the play. It's so much a part of our culture, of Western culture and so forth. And that's, I think, a testament to the power of Shakespeare. But I tried to bring up some of the, what I thought were the more...
Which point in particular did you get resistance on?
The fact that he was not the... if he was a dictator, and he probably did come to be a dictator at some point, as all powerful people do, He was at least a benevolent one, dictator. I honestly believe, contrary to what your previous caller just said, that he did genuinely have the people's interests at heart, at least in some cases. He would not have gone as far as he wanted to go.
Carol, do you want to put a question to Michael Parenti, or should we just comment on that?
Well, I was just making a comment,
Hang with us,
sure.
Michael.
Yeah, I mean, Caesar did appoint libertini to the Senate. The libertini were the sons of slaves, of freedmen, who, because of their own individual abilities and dedication, were elevated to the Senate, which shocked the Senate. And that was kind of a democratic thing. And he appointed a lot of people, including slaves, to positions of responsibility when it was possible, when it was functional. He used people, he used his armies, but crossing the Rubicon, we could debate that one. He had no other choice. They were going to arrest him and kill him, and so he crossed with his army, and the people all through Italy opened up their gates to him. And why did the people like him? Because he was doing these reforms. He was giving them a piece of the pie, and that was something. But, you know, I wanted to say something about the empire and the Republic, if I could, because...
Yeah, that's important.
The Republic itself was an empire. The empire, and Caesar himself was an imperialist. He's no absolute hero to me. I mean, there are things about him that nobody might particularly care for, and most of all would be his imperialism, his conquest of Gaul and such. It's true he felt he'd never get any kind of reforms unless he had an army at his back, because he saw what happened to the Gracchi. He saw what happened to other reformers. They were all assassinated by the Senate oligarchs. So he went, but, you know, he did an awful lot of killing in Gaul and such. And in every one of these cases, the parallel to today is very striking, because the empire feeds off the Republic. The empire gets its resources, its men, its armies, its costs from the Republic. And in a way, the gains, the booty of empire, the plunder of empire, do not go back to the people generally. They really benefit the few at the expense of the many.
Mary,
the people just get his little grain dole, and that's about it.
Michael, I want to bring in Mary on this point.
Yeah. Well, I think you're skipping a step there somehow. There are parallels with today, and I can see it. You know, when Caesar was in Gaul, he didn't really worry about what happened to Gaul after he left. And there's a close parallel there with what we're doing in Iraq. But I think that if you're trying to draw a parallel with what the United States is doing today, there may be some critical differences.
Let me just quickly interrupt and ask you, Mary. We speak of the Roman Republic, and we'll get around to parallels with the U.S.
Wait,
Michael, I'd really like, yeah, what I'm trying to just do is get a definition for listeners who may not be as up to speed on ancient Rome. The Roman Republic, when we say republic, what was that exactly?
Well, it's a form of government that is basically a derivative of the kind of larger oligarchies like the one in Athens. I don't think of the Athenian democracy as a democracy, our kind of democracy, with one person, one vote. It's a big oligarchy, and it's that kind of model that Rome really sprang from, the sort of Greek model that they did their own thing with. And they did have, as the Athenians did, sort of quick changes, constant changes of rulers to prevent the kind of takeover that Julius Caesar and indeed, as Michael Parenti has pointed out, many others before him did.
Michael, you wanted to respond to something Mary had said.
I wanted to say I wasn't drawing parallels to what the United States does in the world. I was pointing out that so today the empire feeds off the republic. The empire, we have 300 major military bases all over the world. We have aircraft carriers making port in every ocean and dozens of countries. We have a military budget of $420 billion. And meanwhile, we have schools where the roofs are falling apart and kids don't have textbooks, and human services are being cut back in every state of the union. That's what I was saying, the parallel of the empire feeding off the republic, and the benefits of that empire do not go to the many. They go to the few in terms of markets and natural resources and investments.
Okay, Carol, I want to thank you for that call and good luck in your acting career. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Sandra is calling from Lynn, Massachusetts.
Well, first of all, I have to say I'm very excited about the show. I teach the Rome of Augustus, and I'm a huge fan of Julius Caesar. And I think shows like this are really important for the promotion of the study of classics, especially because of the parallels between the modern world, the United States, and the Roman world. I'm so excited because I stress this in class almost every day. And the parallels are just, they're extremely obvious, and it's just important for the stressing of history.
What do you think is the biggest parallel?
Well, I mean, you can see the power that the United States wields, the influence, what he was saying before about how there's an aircraft carrier practically every port. Rome had that same type of influence as well. And while I guess we're in the phase where we're not admitting full out that we're an empire, like Rome kind of was during the Republic, we still wield that same type of influence. You know, it's so fascinating. I mean, it's different now because we have you know, advanced communications and technology, so we can wield even more of a worldwide influence. But in the known Roman world, I mean, they influenced almost every country practically. It's fascinating, the connections.
Mary Lefkowitz, do you see the connections in quite that same way, or do you see your particular academic knowledge maybe makes it more difficult to see that kind of connection?
Well, I'm always a little reluctant to draw too many connections with the present, though it's so tempting. And of course, one of the reasons we're interested in the past is because it speaks to us somehow in the present. But of course, we're not in a constitutional crisis yet here in this country, so we have to be careful. There is a great deal of democratic process going into the decisions we make. Now, I share with Michael Parenti the concern that education has been overlooked, and I'm sure I share that with you, Sandra, that the education isn't getting the money it should. Whether that's because we put too much in the military is something else. That's not a decision I can make now.
Sandra, do you think, I mean, I'd like to hear both of you, you as a teaching fellow and Mary as a professor, just argue a bit more about whether there really are close parallels.
Well, I have a big problem trying to get your average college student interested in ancient history. So as much as I can relate it to the modern world as possible, I try. And so maybe I make a bit more effort to see the connections. But I try to even go so far as, you know, asking what they saw on CNN last night and how they – well, it was really easy during the war in Iraq because, I mean, Rome was even in that same area when they were conquering. So I try harder to make the connections to encourage students to actually take history a little bit more seriously and to remember it and see that human nature is history. And it makes it easier, I guess, for them to learn.
Mary.
That seems like a great classroom approach. And I think I do the same thing a great deal in what I teach because But I'm always aware, and I hope they're always aware, that it's a comparison. It's not an exact parallel. And I think that's what we have to be careful about.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Mott is calling from Cape Cod.
Yes, thank you. I live in Rome, and I write on ancient history, just finished a book on the period. And I was very interested in your comments about the New Deal thoughts of Julius Caesar, particularly because the first thing he did when he marched into Rome after the defeat of Pompey was to steal all the gold and silver out of the Temple of Saturn, which had been stored there to defend Rome against the Gauls, because he said, well, now that I've defeated the Gauls, they no longer have a use for this gold. You know, he was a manipulator of people. If there is anyone that you could start drawing parallels to modern times with, it would be his successor, his stepson, Augustus.
Augustus. Let me just quickly ask Michael about the point you were looking for an analogy, and you did come up with New Dealer. What do you say to Mott?
Well, not really. What I said in the book is that every aristocratic reformer from Cleisthenes in ancient Greece to Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 20th century America met the same fate. They were branded as traitors to their class, they were trying to make some reforms and redistributions, and they were pilloried for this as enemies of the system. And I'm saying that Caesar was really a reformer. He wasn't trying to totally destroy the aristocratic class. Not at all. I want to say something about this whole question of parallels. And all. I don't push the parallels that much in the book. I talk about the history. What strikes me is how the ancient historians all agree with the aristocratic perspective. And those ancient historians, including Cicero, who was one of the senators himself and an actor in the very events, they were all elites. They were all slaveholders and all that. And then what even strikes me more is how the modern historians, 95% of them, buy right into it. So this idea that, oh, there are differences in different societies and we have different languages, cultures, perceptions, and we all see these things in terms of our own experience. It really wasn't true. They all saw it the same way that Cicero saw it. It's rather remarkable. They all shared the same elite class ideology.
Mott, do you want to? I just want to bring Mott back in on this, Michael.
A very interesting current event, which occurs every year on March 15th in Rome in the Forum. You can go to the Areopagus or the Ara Caesar. The altar of Caesar, and you can see flowers there on his grave, commemoration of his assassination.
I mentioned that in the book.
Oh, right. You do? Okay, yeah. It's a very interesting sight, and almost a contradiction to what I said to start with. So, I mean, there is a feeling for him, and there remains that feeling.
It's interesting. I said at the top that this is probably the most, if it's not the most important political assassination in history, it's certainly the most remembered. Michael, why is that, do you think? Is it just because of the play?
I think Shakespeare has a lot to do with it, yeah. It's quite a story. I have a whole chapter on the assassination. And he was quite a formidable personality. He was a remarkable speaker, writer, leader of all sorts. He did steal lots of gold. I mentioned that too. But he spread that money around to mobilize support.
Right.
He didn't pocket it.
Okay, the music is up. We're coming up to a break. Connection listeners, we're talking about Julius Caesar. We're talking about his relevance to American political and historical development in the present moment. When we come back, we'll also be talking about the way history is written. I get the sense Michael Parenti is very keen to talk about why it is that it was the elite historians that we still pay attention to. 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. This is The Connection. Hi, Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection. We're talking in this hour about a new book by Michael Parenti called The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. It raises some interesting questions about the motivations of Julius Caesar's assassins and the parallels, some profound, some speculative, between the Roman Republic as it became an empire and the American Republic as it hovers on the brink of being an empire. But we're also talking, because Michael Parenti is very clear in this book, about how history gets written and why this particular story seems to have come down to us, in his view, I think, and Michael, you can correct me if I'm wrong, from the texts of the elites, those who were the elites who were alive when Caesar was alive and documented this, and then later on men like Gibbon, who were educated at the finest schools in England and wrote history that was based on the ancient sources. Now, Mary Lefkowitz is with me in the studio, and she's a professor of classics at Wellesley. Do you agree with Michael Parenti that it's only the elites that inform today's professional historians?
Well, I think primarily.
Primarily.
But I think today's professional historians have been, well, during the whole of my career, which is pretty long, have been getting away from that and trying to look between the cracks, through what is said, and also using documents, the kind of documents that the earlier historians didn't look at, inscriptions, letters, papyrus letters where they exist, things like that. And you get a much different view.
Who sent these letters and made these inscriptions?
Well, all kinds of people made inscriptions, mainly their grave inscriptions, so we're very limited in what they say. They don't give the kind of political opinion that would be very helpful in supporting the kind of thesis Michael Parenti's trying to make. they mostly talk about themselves. But even so, you learn something about the patterns of their lives and the kind of values that they had. And it's that type of material that, in reconstructing the history of women, people like me and many, many other people who are working on the history of women and ordinary people, social history of the ancient world, have been working with.
Well, it's probably a little late in the hour to go. I'm going to come to both of you on this. It's a little late, and it's probably a whole hour in itself. We've spoken of the people of Rome. Michael was quite eloquent in the first part of this segment about it. What was their life, the people of Rome, from what you can tell from these inscriptions and so on?
Well,
both of you. Mary well, first, because I'm looking at her.
Oh, okay. I think that we can tell that, you know, the more money you had, the happier you were, but that there was a great deal of upward mobility. What you can't tell, as I said, is what their political opinions were and what they thought of the kinds of issues that we're talking about here. But you do get a sense of the things they did, and the inscriptions tell you that, and unless you look at them, you don't really know that.
Michael? What do you know?
Well, you can also get an idea of some of their opinions. For one thing, they were not a bunch of layabouts and rabble. They worked very hard to keep body and soul together. They supported and they fought for the popular assemblies. They challenged the rich. And we do have lots of letters, as Mary well knows, of the elites who Cicero, for instance, when you get away from his De Republica and his official writings and look at his letters and letters from Cassius and others and Brutus that are in his collection, it's sort of like listening to private telephone conversations, and they're speaking off the record, and they say some very revealing things.
For example,
their hatred of the people as just a bunch of scum, their fear and hatred of democracy of any sort, the fact that it wasn't Caesar they hated. When Caesar was killed and Mark Antony convinced the Senate to keep all his reforms intact because the people were boiling over all through the city and attacking rich people, and Cicero has a very interesting letter, which I haven't seen many historians deal with, but I did. He said, this is ridiculous. We're keeping all the things that we hated Caesar for. And that was very interesting. It wasn't his ambition or his rudeness or this or that or the other charges, ad hominem charges that are always made against popular leaders. It was his reforms. It was those things, and that's what they hated and feared. And the people, you know, fought for a secret ballot. They supported when Caesar put through a luxury tax and put a cap on wealth. He said no, people can't have any more than 15,000. I forget what it was, gold drachmas or whatever, whatever the particular coin. There were a number of coins being used in Rome at the time. That was all. There were popular leaders who said, "Great, and we can have slaves and servants in the rich houses." Spying on them and reporting how they hoard or violate this law. Well, Caesar was against that. The great popularis, the great popular leader, that was too much for him to have servants and slaves reporting on
them. I want to quickly bring Mary back in here, Michael, in San Francisco, and then go to the calls.
Well, I agree with a great deal of what you're saying, but I certainly read those letters when I studied Roman history, and we were encouraged to use all that kind of sources and to really read between the lines. You know, we were raised sort of after Ronald Syme wrote his Roman Revolution, and he began after Actium Augustus had all the legions. That was a new view of Roman history. You began to look at it as a power struggle and to see it in terms of the world at that time.
800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Paul is calling from East Hampstead, New Hampshire.
Hi, both Michaels. I'm a Brit, as you'll gather by the accent, and I was raised and educated in the British private school system, which we confusingly refer to as public schools. And I was raised on Latin. Latin was taught in our schools because it was deemed that you cannot learn English unless you first understand Latin. And you cannot understand history unless you understand the Romans. And, of course, I dealt with my fair share of translations of the Gallic Wars and so on and so forth. My point is this. It was imbued into us that civilization stopped where the Roman Empire stopped. which is why we have all the problems in Ireland, because they never had the advantage of being subjugated by the Romans, and why the Scots were always so difficult, because the Ninth Legion was lost to the rabble in Scotland in the Dark Ages. And the Roman Empire stopped at the Carpathian Mountains, because after that was just barbarians. And though this is a slightly facetious comment that was made to me, and of course I was raised on this, I wanted to ask a question about the concept of Pax Romanus and Pax Americanus.
Romana.
Romana. I beg your pardon. You see, it just shows how little Latin I recall.
Paul, I was going to ask you when you were educated at public school.
I was educated in the 1960s.
Okay. And, not so long ago that you should have forgotten that particular...
don't scold the man
okay,
now.
All right.
Latin is now useful for me for translating war memorials and the like.
Okay.
But my point is this. Where the Romans scored was settling their subjugated nations with their own people. Why did Gaul survive, and why did Britain survive so long into the 4th and 5th centuries AD? Why? Because the Romans had settled there. So we look at modern-day parallels, and we see what the United States is seeking to do, and it would be the view of some people that they're seeking to subjugate the nations of the Middle East. We all know that that isn't true, but that's how it's perceived. So how do we introduce Pax Americanus? Would that be right, or would it be Americana?
Americana.
Pax
Americana.
And there is my little parallel, and I'll sit back and wait for your erudition.
Who wants to be erudite first? Mary?
Well, I think that we certainly have been using the rhetoric that we want to introduce democracy wherever we go without really thinking how difficult it is to introduce democracy and to get people to do the kinds of things that make a successful democratic society. And we always seem to give the impression that the world would be better off if everyone were like Americans, and I think that may be a mistake. On the other hand, we are probably doing what the Romans did in some respects. One looks at the world, say, in the 2nd century A.D., what remains of that, and Gibbon says that was the happiest time of mankind, and it doesn't. The architectural remains seem to suggest a time of peace because there were such wonderful public buildings and so few fortifications. So I think that like everything in history, it seems there are at least two sides to it.
Michael?
Could I have one solid minute?
You can have one solid minute, and then I've got one last phone call.
Joseph Schumpeter, a conservative economist, he wrote this in 1919. I have it in my book. He talks about Rome's imperialism, that policy which pretends to aspire to peace but unerringly generates war, the policy of continual preparation for war, the policy of meddlesome interventionism. There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under attack. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, always fighting for a breathing space. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their aggressive designs. Now, does any of that sound familiar to you?
Paul, I want to thank you for your call and your remembering Latin. John is calling from Brighton, Massachusetts.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I teach Latin in Walpole, Massachusetts, and my comment is this. I think this whole the whole difficulty in finding parallels and comparisons between our society and Rome's is easily mirrored in the often mistranslation of Rome's motto, SPQR, Senatus Populusque Romanus, the Senate and the Roman people. But the populus, as no doubt you would be familiar, as far as I understand anyway, does not necessarily or does not refer to the common people, the populist, but rather the military elite. And I'll take my answer off the air and thank you for discussing this.
Thank you, John. Michael, that's your book. Do you agree with that?
Well, no, I think, the people were a real concern and constant factor in Roman rule. The people were a problem. You got to milk them. You got to tax them. You got to make them work for practically nothing. You got to steal their land from them. The whole Campania region was stolen from the small farmers. It became big slave-worked latifundia plantations. The people... it's true, those people, those common people, were never seen by the elites in Caesar.
But was John's point...
Not Caesar, by Cicero.
Is John's point actually correct that because it's new to me, that the populus in Senatus Populusque Romana actually refers not to the people, as you would mean it, Michael, in writing a people's history of ancient Rome, but rather to an elite?
No. The populace does refer to the people. I guess I'd have to differ. They had a presence in the Roman Republic. They were in the assemblies. They spoke they shouted in the forum. They actually didn't speak. They could, select few could speak by invitation of the magistrates. But the people were actors. They were the people's tribunes, which actually could veto some of the decrees that were handed down by the Roman Senate.
Okay.
So they were real actors.
Okay.
Ask Mary. She might know that there's some special meaning to that term.
I sort of agree with you on that, Michael.
Okay. Yeah. Now, we are coming to the end of the hour, and I would like to go another hour, and perhaps we will, especially if the Bush administration carries on in the way it's carrying on. But, Mary, we sometimes lose sight of Caesar. He has become a legend, and we all know what happened in the capital on the Ides of March 44 B.C., and we all know what his last words were. Now, as a classical scholar, what exactly did he say when Brutus put the knife in?
Well, according to Suetonius, he said, "Kai sou technon," which in Greek means "you too, my son." But "kai sou" has a negative meaning, and it can be a kind of curse. And it's almost, I don't want to say on a public family radio what it means.
Say it. Go ahead. Say it.
Something like "up yours" would be pretty much what he said to Brutus, according to Suetonius. And at that point, he is not saying something kindly at all, but he sees what role Brutus was playing in the conspiracy very well.
Oh, so it isn't sadness at seeing his close friend joining the conspirators
against
him? No,
saying he hopes he gets the same as he gave.
And he gets it too, doesn't he?
He does.
Mary Lefkowitz, thank you very much for joining us. Mary Lefkowitz is professor of classics at Wellesley College. Thank you very much, Michael Parenti, for your book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, A People's History of Ancient Rome. Michael was in a studio in San Francisco. I apologize for interrupting you. It's always harder when I can't look you in the eye. Thank you very much, Michael Parenti. And Connection listeners, to continue this conversation online, you can visit the forum section of our website, theconnection.org. Our senior producer is Tara Murphy. I'm Michael Goldfarb. This is The Connection.